You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And today we're going to talk about fundraising, which is obviously important to every nonprofit organization if they're hoping to or have any shot at achieving their objectives. Well, we're going to talk about a specific aspect of fundraising, that is, how an organization might go about selecting a consultant to help them think through their fundraising strategies and what other services they might get from a consultant. And we're also going to talk about some block and tackle fundraising techniques. So all development officers and board members who are listening, you're going to want to take some notes from my guest, Barbara O'Reilly, who is a principal at the consulting firm Windmill Hill Consultants. Barbara, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you, Art. I'm so delighted to be here to chat with you today.
Well, Barbara, you know, we were talking before the podcast began, and boy, it's been a while since we've had a chance to connect. In fact, the first time I think we actually worked together was at an AFP conference, was it? Or maybe it was a Washington, D.C. fundraising conference or something. And you and I were on a panel together that you were leading, and we had a chance to talk about something called the overhead myth. And then I think we also got a chance to partner on a nice project you did as well, that really got a lot of attention on social media, which I'll let you talk about later on. But I wanted to just, you know, start the conversation out by just asking a little bit more about you. How did you get into this work, and what sort of spurred you in your life to kind of dig in this way to helping nonprofit organizations?
So my origin story, well, so you and I both know a time when fundraising was not a recognized career, wasn't a profession that people said, gosh, when I grow up, I want to be a fundraiser. And frankly, it's only more recently that there have been more professional educational tracks. You and I both teach at different universities in nonprofit leadership and fundraising and management. And that sort of formal education has only come about over the last, you know, couple of decades. But there, when I was younger, I definitely did not think, when I grow up, I want to be a fundraiser. I was aware of philanthropy, and you know, I think my parents donated in some way to some organizations, but it was not anything that we talked about. And I was definitely a recipient of scholarships and other financial awards going through school. And so I was aware that people donated money to make those available. And I remember in high school being in, I think, a social studies class, and we were talking about sort of some, you know, community issues. How do you solve for community issues, whatever it was at the time, whether the topic was. And I remember sort of saying in an offhanded way, well, there are philanthropic sources or solutions that could help to solve whatever the problem was. And I don't know how I even knew that was sort of the bigger meta issue or solution, but it was something that I clearly had deep in my mind. And when I went to college, you know, I thought I was going to do lots of other things. And I needed a summer job after my junior year of college and called up the alumni office where I was going to school and said, do you have any work looking for a summer job? So I ended up taking a position as to the director of development as his, sort of his assistant, and just, you know, did his correspondence and I did research for him. And I learned all about the world of alumni relations and fundraising. And I kept going and working in that way for the whole senior year. When I graduated, I still wasn't entirely sure what I wanted to do. I started looking for fundraising jobs, but really kind of not seriously, because I thought, well, I'll do this until I can figure out what it is I really want to do. And I had a faculty advisor who asked if I wanted to work, if I was interested in moving. I was going to school in New York, as you know, and I had this faculty advisor who said, but, you know, I've got this friend who works at Harvard. Do you think you might want to move to Boston? And I thought, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. And my mom said, are you crazy? Like, you should explore the job at Harvard. So I talked to who was the dean for alumni affairs. I took a job as an assistant to major gift officers, and I kept on, and I kept thinking I wasn't going to stay in this profession. Thought they still had this idea I was going to do something else. But as I got to know more and more about fundraising, as I understood about it's about building donor relationships, as I saw sort of the wider view of philanthropy, I kept taking positions that were increasing responsibility in different organizations, and it became something. Here I am 30 years later. I so appreciate the many facets that go into nonprofit management, that go into fundraising.
I was just going to say it's so cool because most people wouldn't grow up thinking, I'm going to be a fundraiser.
Never, never. No one I haven't met one yet.
You know, and I also wonder sometimes if fundraisers are made or born. You know, I kind of think there may be a combination of both, but nowadays there's so many ways for people to learn the profession of fundraising that I think, and I would like to get your reaction to this, can anybody be a fundraiser if they put the work in and learn the profession?
So there's definitely an art and science to fundraising, for sure. And I agree with you. I think there's a balance between those who are sort of born to be fundraisers and those who can learn the skills to be fundraisers. I don't think that just anybody can be, because, and this is actually why I get a little tense when I see, you know, job descriptions, fundraising job descriptions that say sales experience, you know, or sort of related fields like that. Because fundraising is, I mean, there's relationship to sales, but it isn't really sales. It's so much more than that. It's about building relationships. It's about listening. It's about, there's some strategy that's involved. It's about understanding how to make a case for support in a way that will inspire, in a way that will align with a donor's own personal values. And so I don't think that fundraising is for everybody. There are definitely senior leaders, board members who can learn how to fundraise, but to be really strong fundraisers, you've got to have those skills partially innate and then developed for sure.
Interesting. So what are some of the more innate skills that you would present or you would look for?
Top is the ability to listen and to listen really well. You know, there's a sort of misconception that good fundraisers are extroverts and are really good sales, you know, so you can make a pitch and can talk fast and talk a lot. I am not an extrovert for sure, but I'm a really good listener. And so I can ask questions. I can listen for cues that will come up in the conversation. I am not one that will sort of lead with a pitch because none of us want to start a conversation that way. And I'd say that's probably the number one skill, is knowing when to talk, when to listen, and how to connect those dots. Because especially whether you're talking at a, you know, sort of a wider base of fundraising, you know, to, you know, sort of the annual giving kind of model, or you're talking to those donors who are stepping up to those mid-level or certainly those large gifts, you've got to understand those donors well, and you have to understand what drives them, what doesn't drive them, and where the best alignment is with what they have in mind for their philanthropy. And that's, I think, the top skill. I think there's also, I would say the second is being able to build relationships. So not everyone's going to be your donor, your organization's donor, but the ones that do, that are going to support your organization and support them over time, well, at whatever level, frankly, but those transformational gifts come with strong relationships that have been built over often years. So being able to understand, just like we would with personal relationships, frankly, how do you think about that person's interests and maybe share some insights that would be of interest to them? Remembering personal things, you know, their a birthday or some sort of milestone for them, or remembering that they like something and bringing that into the conversation, or sending them a note when you've heard some good news about them, or maybe some not so good news, and showing that you're there for them beyond just that, you know, that sort of teeing it up for that ask, whenever that may be. So I think there, when we think about fundraising and only focus on those numbers, we forget, we can forget that there are people behind it and that there are those timelines, their interests. And that's where knowing how to build those relationships and how to listen intently so that you can time those asks with what makes the most sense for those donors, you know, in the long run.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the word relationship, and obviously that is key to almost any type of success. You know, you have to work with other folk and you need to be able to develop solid relationships. But I also think that for some people, the whole relationship building practice could be somewhat of a disadvantage, at least getting started. So let me give you an example. For people of color who don't have necessarily access to folk, it's more difficult, I think, to begin those relationships, you know, because you have to reach out to people who don't know you and you don't have necessarily a great portfolio of friends or contacts who have access to these people. How does one begin that process? So, you know, I mean, if you're in an organization that's mature, I suspect the organization can position you so that you get access. But if you're in an organization that's just getting started, it's got to be very difficult for people, and maybe not only people of color, but people who don't have access to wealth, for instance, to actually begin those relationships. How do they go about it? What are some thoughts you might have to get those type of individuals in the game, so to speak?
So I think about it in that short and long-term view. So the short-term is, where are the more obvious and maybe the easier opportunities to get some capacity building funding so that you as an organization, as a fundraiser, can then develop the research and the staff capacity, maybe the marketing capacity to start to build the brand for that organization and bring in other team members to help with those relationships on a larger basis, under doing the capacity building for research to know who are the people that we should be talking to. If you have any donor base or any mailing list of any kind, being able to have the funds to do some, you know, research into that to see, are there people here who could be giving to us? If they're subscribers, who can we convert into donors to your organization? So I think there's that short term of, can we find the financial resources, perhaps through foundations, right? Some foundations are, I think they're increasingly looking to build the capacities of organizations. And, you know, you and I both know that for so often, foundations were only given capacity building grants to current grantees. So I've seen over the last couple of years, many more foundations are releasing those restricted grants and making them more unrestricted and a little bit more flexible. So I think starting in that way to get a little bit more financial resources under that organization's belt so they can start to build that momentum. The longer term, though, is to look at this as not just think about this in who can give us the large amounts of money, because we were talking about this before this podcast, but those lower and mid-level donors are disappearing because organizations are not paying attention to them. And this is not a criticism. This is just, we get sort of caught up in the mega gifts that are being announced and those, where can we find those 6, 7, 8-figure gifts? But those lower and mid-level donors are the most reliable in many ways. They're the ones that are less susceptible to the fluctuations in the economy and the stock market. They are the ones who usually have higher retention year over year. So I think there's the opportunity over a long period is to build that culture where every donor is appreciated, no matter their level, their gift level, and creating that sense of community. That doesn't mean that you're not going for larger gifts from individuals, but as you are building that sort of pipeline and that donor base, you're going to want to have those donors of all levels, because frankly, some of those donors might have potential for larger gifts. They're just not giving it yet. You know, they're testing the water. Their first gift is never their best gift. So, you know, thinking about it from that, you know, that's the long game and the long-term view that the organization is going to have to take. But when you're a new organization or you're a smaller organization, you feel that pressure of meeting those budget goals. And so looking at that short term of where can we find some institutional support, perhaps, that we can use to build our capacity internally.
Yeah, that's good advice. So you are with a consulting firm that helps organizations strategize about their fundraising practices. What are some of the more important services that organizations should look to a consultant to help them with?
So the benefit of having a consultant is that we bring an external and an objective perspective. In having been in-house for 16 years in organizations and then now moving out to being a consultant, I can see both sides. So, you know, when you're in-house, you are so caught up in the day-to-day operations. You're so caught up in all of the things that are on your to-do list. You have a very particular view of your challenges and opportunities. And it's sometimes hard to take a step back to think of where do we need to take this organization or where are our blind spots, because you may not be able to see them. So having an objective voice to it, like a consultant, to say, These are the conditions for growing your fundraising. If that's one area, and that's pretty much every area that's a goal that every organization wants at some point. But we can use our objectivity and our collective experiences to assess and see with objectivity, right? So we are looking at the data, their donor data. We're looking at their operations, we're looking at external perceptions of an organization, and we're not tied to those, right? We don't take them personally. And so we are looking at this and saying, what is the universe of this organization? And where are the opportunities? Where are the hindrances? Where are the recommendations? How do we recommend the best way forward for this organization's capacities and where they want to go? And so I feel like that's probably one of the biggest benefits, is being able to have that external lens through to see their organization. We have the ability to bring a depth of learning and experience. And I'm a lifetime learner myself. And so I'm always thinking and learning about research that's being done or studies, or what are the trends that we're seeing, and historically building on now the present, what are the things that how do we see around that corner, so to speak? So that's another aspect of a consultant would bring to an organization, is really having that macro view of what's going on in the sector, so that, and use that to inform and help them to see what their next steps might be. Because, you know, this is a crowded landscape. No organization operates in isolation. So understanding what those macro trends are and issues is really important. And it's when you're in-house and doing the day-to-day work, sometimes it's hard to be able to lift your head up and say, and see, you know, see the forest for the trees, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the big currencies, and I think the most important currency in our sector, and obviously it affects fundraising too, is this whole notion of trust. You know, we need for people to trust organizations. Otherwise, why would they give them money if they didn't trust them? And so there have to be ways for organizations to go about demonstrating that trustworthiness. At the same time, though, some of the ways in which we express trustworthiness doesn't necessarily help an organization in its fundraising. So for example, you know, the notion that organizations have to manage their overhead to make it as small as possible can sometimes hinder an organization's ability to raise money. But this is what many donors expect. So how do you advise organizations that are in that predicament? You know, you want to demonstrate trustworthiness, you want to show efficiency, but the reality is that unless you spend money, you're not really going to be able to raise a whole lot. So what do you suggest to organizations about that whole conundrum, so to speak?
So that overhead myth is definitely one of my soapboxes. And in fact, that's how we met, right? Because that was that panel about the overhead myth.
It's really an overhead dilemma almost nowadays.
For sure. That and donor retention are two of my biggest soapboxes that I am constantly talking about. So there are two things I say to organizations. The first is, what do those good outcomes cost? And I am totally stealing from a video that was done by, I think it was the San Antonio Council of Nonprofits. They did a whole PSA that's on trying to counter this. You know, how do we explain that overhead, so program and admin costs, are actually all about program organizational impact? And so they did a great piece about that. And you paraphrase that question, one of the questions that was in that video, which was, you know, what do good outcomes cost? So it comes down to, and it was in your donor trust study that I think it was the 2021 report, that donors are looking for that sense of impact. We know that's the number one driver for donors in all the research about donor motivations. That's the top of the list. And it was interesting that it came up as one of those criteria for determining the levels of trust that they have in nonprofits. So I would say, really getting a handle on what are the impacts that we as an organization need to achieve towards our vision. And more often than not, organizations are not always clear on what that vision is. I will sometimes rephrase it to a client and say, what does it mean to put yourself out of business because you have solved the problem you were set up to solve, whatever it might be? That's a tough way for organizations to think about it because nobody wants to put themselves out of business. But when you talk about mission delivery, 100% mission fulfillment, that's a very different way. So I think getting a handle on what that impact will look like, and then what does that cost? And then backing it out into what do we need in terms of financial resources, and what are those revenue sources now? I always caution or advise organizations that their startup costs, especially if they have been more heavily funded by public sources, for example, grants, contracts, things like that, they may not have as robust a development department and fundraising costs as they need if they want to scale and diversify to individuals, digital, you know, direct marketing and so forth. That's going to probably be the first couple of years a higher percentage as they ramp up those costs of getting staff, getting the database in place, getting other tech resources and so forth. So I always advise them to be thinking about the true impact and how they articulate that and how they communicate that. And then really try to encourage them to weather the early days of maybe higher than comfort level fundraising costs so that they can eventually get up to that economy of scale where they have enough staff who are raising enough money and that whole sort of overhead is not an issue because they're raising more money and it sort of balances itself out. I know you have a good guideline of about, 35%. And I feel like that's a reasonable amount, because if they're spending more money on fundraising and they're not recouping it, well, then there's probably something else at play that needs to be evaluated. So I think that's a good benchmark to be working against. But in those early days, if they need to ramp up or need to try something different, they have to suspend that discomfort, keeping an eye on those numbers, because they're never going to be able to scale if they aren't investing in those early, in those innovative ideas.
Yeah. Well, we try to tell people that an organization shouldn't spend any more than 35 cents to raise a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for most organizations we evaluate, they're fine operating within that parameter.
Mm-hmm.
But I sometimes ask myself, what if we didn't have a percentage at all? What difference would it make to organizations and their impact, and to donors for that matter, who are looking for ways to assess the trustworthiness of organizations? They've tended to use this percentage as one way of determining whether an organization is worthy of their support. And so my question, Barbara, to you is, if we didn't have that as a percentage, that percentage as a metric, if that didn't exist, how might we go about determining the trustworthiness of organizations that are out there soliciting, for instance? Are there other things we could do in your mind that would indicate, for instance, well, this organization is spending maybe significant money on fundraising, but they're still a trustworthy group and they're still working hard to accomplish a mission. So what else might we tell donors to look at and to pay attention to, if not those numbers?
One of the things that I feel needs to be elevated and amplified a little bit more is, and this really does tie to the overhead issue, is the full capacity that's required for success. But it isn't just being able to have the right number of staff and being able to pay them competitively. Those are absolutely important. But does the organization, is it investing enough in itself to be thinking innovatively, creatively, and comprehensively to deliver its programs? Because the ones that are really sort of holding themselves back because of perceptions of mismanagement of their funds, or because they feel like the donors are going to be frustrated and annoyed that, you know, X percent, and they start to sort of rate the percentages that are going for program and non-program purposes, they're missing the point, right? So we want organizations that are able to do the research and the pilot things and test and innovate, which they can't do if they're focused on hitting very rigid, what they feel like might be rigid budgets or percentages of how costs should be allocated. So, you know, when we think about our for-profit colleagues, nobody cares how much Apple, for example, might spend on their budget breakdown. But what we really care about at the end is the latest iPhone or the Apple Watch or something else. And we want that advanced technology. We want that that's going to make our lives a little bit easier or integrated with all of our other devices. That comes from research and development, the R&D budget, for example. So in correlating that to the nonprofit sector, I would want to be seeing nonprofits, more nonprofits, allowing themselves that opportunity to really test and determine what is their best program, for example, what are the best partnerships without feeling like they're held back. So even, for example, and we see this especially in fundraising, there's a fear of failure, and we aren't allowing ourselves that opportunity to try different fundraising techniques. So if we send out a direct mail appeal and it doesn't recoup as much as we anticipated, there's that sort of knee-jerk reaction of, well, we're not going to do that again. We're not going to mail again because that costs us too much and we didn't raise enough. Well, that takes time, or digital or online or doing different kinds of events. Those are going to take time and it costs money, but you're going to need to test it and tweak it and try it. And we're so always focused on what are the things in fundraising, what are the things that we know is going to raise us money and is not going to rock the boat and is going to keep us going. Same thing for the whole organization. So I would say organizations that can have that ability to think flexibly and creatively. And that's what I would hope donors are increasingly looking at, because if they don't have the capacity and the innovation at the organizational level, they're never going to be able to do the program effectiveness and the impact that's required to solve these big problems. And we know that's what donors want. And so why can't we give the nonprofits that latitude and that freedom to be able to take some risks and test and grow in really creative ways to solve these very big problems that we face?
Well, you know, that's so interesting, because I've always believed that even focusing on impact might not be the best place for a donor to pay attention to, because often nonprofits don't achieve the impact that they have in mind. They're experimenting. They're constantly trying different things to solve problems that are really difficult to solve. I think they can be impactful, but maybe they aren't as impactful as they set out to be. But what I think draws a donor, or certainly would draw me as a donor, is what are the organization's ideas? What are their plans? How solid and sensible and rational is their approach to solving the problem? Because we're not funding them for what they did in the past. We're funding them because of what we hope they'll be able to do in the future. And I think that we don't, as donors, pay enough attention to how an organization is set to do things in the future. So it would be my hope that, you know, we would be able to convince people more to pay attention to that. Even an impact report is looking backwards. It's looking backwards at what we did. What we need to know is what we're going to do. What are we going to do next? And I think the trust comes in when we can show that what an organization said it was going to do, it actually tried to do. Doesn't mean it always succeeds at that, but it had an approach to solving a problem and it went after it. And later on, we can report what we did, and a donor can show that, can see that they've done something that now they can be proud of, or that maybe they are learning something from what they did. So I think the forward look is a piece that's often missing, particularly in a world that is full of shifts and change and dilemmas and crises that organizations have to deal with on a day-to-day basis and in a very dynamic environment that we find ourselves in these days. So I hope donors take heed to that.
No, that's a great point. And it actually reminded me, and I don't remember who did this, a number of years back, I heard of an organization that did a failure report. And they were just mentioning sort of this fear of failure pervades the sector. And what was really innovative about this report was that they were talking about all the different things that they had tried or done that year, what didn't work, and what they learned from it. So to your point about looking forward, I think that that sort of sense of not just the impact, which yes, does look backwards, what do we learn from the things that didn't work? And again, that's where we have to suspend our that fear of failure and just accept that that's all those are all learning opportunities. But I think you're right. You've hit on something about, and especially over the last couple of years since the pandemic started, there's this feeling of sort of stuck in the moment, and we don't allow ourselves to look ahead. And so that's why so often the organizations don't have strategic plans, or don't use their strategic plans, or don't write them well, and they become laundry lists of activities and tactics, instead of saying, where do we want to take this organization in a couple of years, and what's it going to take to get there? Especially since March of 2020, every strategic plan was ripped up and rewritten or tossed out the window completely. But I think that's exactly right, in that, you know, which organizations can look ahead and build on what they've done, certainly build on what they've learned, and still chart a way forward, knowing that this is about solving those problems, but in a way that's collaborative and designed to involve not just perhaps other partners, but our donors as well, and our stakeholders, and our clients, those whom we serve.
Barbara, we're getting close to the end of the interview, but I wanted to ask you two things. First, I noticed that you are CFRE, Certified Fundraising Executive. I am a member of the board of CFRE, and I would like for you to explain to the public the importance of that designation and why it's so meaningful to you.
So I became a CFRE a little later in my career, but it was, to me, because I feel very strongly that this fundraising is a profession. And that's a whole different, there are many who don't feel it's a profession. And that's a completely different discussion. But I feel like fundraising is a career and it's a profession. And just like financial advisors or others who have very rigorous accreditation that's required in order for them to do their jobs, the same applies for fundraising. And so the body of knowledge, the importance and emphasis on ethics, the standard sort of sense of leadership and responsibility and expertise that the CFRE conveys and can embody is an important signal for boards and CEOs and other fundraising professionals that this isn't just anybody can do it. And so it really does require sort of a rigor of expertise and knowledge. So that to me is one of the biggest drivers that really impelled me to become a CFRE. You know, I believe in the standardization of knowledge. I taught a CFRE review course with two of my friends and colleagues through AFP this year. I was really so honored to be able to share what I've learned over the course of my 30 years to this next class of CFRE members. And the more we can do this, the more people can see that this is a distinct career with distinct skills and expertise that's required.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, because it is a profession and there are people who spend their lives making sure that they do it well, but that they also treat donors with respect and a certain degree of integrity as well, that they're not abusing the opportunities they get to give people chances to support things that they believe in. Here's the last question for you. You know, we all have jobs that some days bring us some joy, but not as much joy as we like. And other days they bring us tremendous joy. As a fundraiser, I want you to think back to some of the most joyful days that you've had raising money and helping others raise money, and give us sort of the story behind that. Can you think of a few or one situation that over the course of your career has brought you joy that even when you think about it, you just get a good feeling about?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say there are a couple different moments. One is when I was at the American Red Cross National Headquarters. I was new on the staff and had inherited a donor portfolio from another team member who was leaving. I was working with a corporate donor audience. So I managed corporate relationships for much of the Northeast. And one donor in particular company was pledged a significant amount of money to a particular disaster. And when I started, they said, oh, this company has pledged it. It's pretty much a done deal. Just have to tie up the loose ends. And as I got to talk to that company representative and got to know them a little bit more, it took a lot longer. It wasn't assumed. It wasn't a done deal. And so over probably a period of about a year, I think, maybe 8 months of pretty frequent meetings, I built the relationship. I built the trust with that program officer and finally got to the point where I said, we've offered all these different things. And what's still holding you back to finalizing this, to formalizing this gift? And then that opened up a completely different conversation. And what we found out was that there were things that we were missing that I didn't know, because they had preceded me and I didn't catch in the conversations. And so that put us on a completely different trajectory. And ultimately, we got to a point where that company and that donor felt completely comfortable with the way that we were going to be spending their funds. And when we finally closed it, it was the largest international gift that we had received. But it was about pausing and rethinking and rebuilding that trust in a way that was really aligned with that donor. And I would say the other moments were less specific, but more seeing progress. So seeing alumni who were reconnected with their university year over year because of the engagement and the outreach that I had done or that we had done collectively through very specific outreach to them. Or when I was at the National Trust for Historic Preservation, I was on their first campaign team and I was there for part of their campaign. And then we moved out of the country. And when I came back to become their director of development many years later for their second campaign, all the infrastructure and the groundwork of building those donor relationships that had begun in the first campaign were just the launching off pad for an even bigger effort. And so that was really great to see, was that it was that collective progress overall for the organization. And I would say that it goes back to the first comment I made about being able to build relationships. So whether it was me individually building a relationship with the donor to make them feel satisfied and really trusting in this decision, to collectively, how do we build an engaged audience, donor audience, so that they are ready and inspired and excited to keep stepping up their contributions. This is the beauty of fundraising, right? And to see that in play, those are the moments that really make me pleased and smile.
Okay. I know I said that was the last question, but I do have one more.
Okay.
So what is it that keeps you motivated? Because as a fundraiser, it seems to me that you always have to be up. You have to expect that you're going to get a certain amount of no's when you ask for money, and you still have to be positive about it. What do you do? How do you keep yourself positive and upbeat, especially when you know that you're not going to raise the kind of money that you expect every single time out?
It's the mission. So whether I was in-house or now when I'm working with clients, you know, these are incredible organizations doing incredible work, addressing big issues, big problems that our world and our communities face. And as Pollyanna as that seems, that's what keeps me motivated. It's the lives that are changed. It's the communities that are transformed. It's making the world a better place. And I think, you know, when I at the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned that even as early as high school, I was aware that philanthropy had this power, this transformative power. And I think at my core, that's what still drives me, is how do we unleash more of that power for greater good? And that's the beauty that fundraisers and their donors together can do, can achieve. So as frustrating as sometimes things can be for all of us, it's, and especially during a time of upheaval like we faced over the last 2 years, keeping our eyes on those bigger issues and the bigger results that can be achieved because of the power of philanthropy. That's what I hold on to, and I have to sort of ground myself in from time to time.
Well, thank you for that. You've been listening to Barbara O'Reilly, who is a principal with Windmill Hill Consulting. They help organizations raise money. And we've just had a wonderful conversation, Barbara. I'm so thankful that you joined me on this episode of the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Art. It was really such a pleasure to be able to chat with you and to be on this podcast. Thank you for including me.
And to all of our listeners, I want to thank you for tuning in. And for those of you who are new to the show, you can find us on all major podcast platforms. And if you do, I hope you'll subscribe so that you can get all future episodes sent to you as they come out each week. And if you'd like to support us financially, please do so by going to give.org, our website, where you can make a contribution to the Wise Giving Alliance, or you can also support us on Patreon. So find us there as well. Thank you for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. BEAN.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.